This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel. Every year, NPR asks a writer to compose a story with a Christmas theme. This year's story comes from Gregory Maguire. He's the author of the novel Wicked, which is the basis for the Tony Award-winning Broadway musical of the same name. Maguire's new story reinvents the Hans Christian Andersen classic, The Little Match Girl, by creating new characters and expanding the 19th-century fairy tale. It begins on Christmas Eve with a boy named Frederick and his mother. Here's Gregory Maguire reading Matchless.
On an island so far north that it snowed from September to April, a boy named Frederick kept himself warm by keeping a secret. Some mornings, the top of the water in the kitchen jug had frozen into a disk of ice. Frederick had to smash it with a wooden spoon. He piled the pieces of ice in a saucer, reminded of the way that harbor ice broke up in a thaw. Small ice made musical clinking sounds. Large ice groaned like his mother.
"Not dawn, not yet," she protested through her morning congestion. "The troubles of another day come to haunt me. Where are you, my sweet ginger biscuit?"
"I'm making your tea to warm you up," replied Frederick. He hurried to light the kitchen fire. Money was scarce, and this was the last match until his mother could afford to buy more, so he struck it carefully. The warmth on his fingers made him want, quick, to use them to make something clever before they became stiff with cold again. His fingers were the only clever part of him.
"My useful child," said the widow Peterson. "Tea on a cold morning? A reason to live.
But this?" She grimaced.
"Bah! It's thin as rainwater. Have you made one scoop of leaves do for a whole pot?"
"The canister is nearly empty."
"It's Christmas Eve. I'm paid today. I'll buy some more.
We need matches, too." As Dame Peterson and Frederick folded the bedding, their breath wisped in the chilly room. "Look, it's a pair of ghosts."
"That's all that'll be left of us, a pair of ghosts, unless you succeed today."
The Petersons lived in a couple of rooms tacked onto a herring smokehouse on an island in the harbor. From their threshold, Frederick looked across the water to the prosperous city on the mainland. The town was bedecked with necklaces of evergreen. Setting out across the low stone causeway that joined island to mainland, Frederick caught a whiff of a goose roasting for a holiday luncheon. As fishermen emptied their nets of herring or scrat or mackerel, gulls filched from the day's catch. If Frederick could startle a scavenger into dropping a fish, why, there was the beginning of supper. The fishermen didn't begrudge Frederick stealing from seagulls. When fish were few, Frederick searched for bits of beautiful trash, anything he might use for his secret. His mother didn't suspect a thing. Every night when she came home from the palace, she was a seamstress for the queen, Dame Peterson fried the fish and then plunged under the warm coverlet to do her mending there. The queen had a heavy foot and always stepped on her own hems. So every evening, Frederick's mother reached for her basket of threads, all wrapped tightly on wooden spools. Even on Christmas Eve, she plied her needle. She stitched while Frederick washed up. As soon as she knotted off over her scissors, Frederick scampered up the ladder to his attic. The room reeked with the salt tang of the sea and the sweet rawness of the smokehouse. He didn't mind. This was his room, to which his mother, in her exhaustion, could never manage to climb. Here, he was not fish thief, but governor. On the planks of the attic floor waited Frederick's secret, a town hunched on an island. The houses were made of empty boxes that he'd lifted from shopkeepers' rubbish bins. Frederick cut out windows and folded the cardboard. perfect hinged shutters. He built eaves out of slates that the wind had liberated from real roofs. He planted trees by poking sprigs of balsam into dollops of boat caulking. Best was the customs house, a gold-papered chocolate gift box sporting a porcelain dome. Frederickstown boasted only two residents, two threadless wooden spools with heads made out of acorns. They seemed eager to invite other people to their town, but Frederick didn't know where to find any. Frederick had decided that the residents should go sailing to hunt for more family. Next, he would need a boat. When someone pounded at the door, his mother started from her nap.
"Merciful angels! Have the seagulls grown fists?"
Frederick reached the door first. The visitor said to Dame Peterson,
"Our queen has ripped her cloak on her way to the Christmas Eve ceremonies. She's to preside over prayers and feast and frolic of all varieties, so she demands you come with your supplies. But dress snug. Ice is even forming on the harbor."
"You would think the queen has toes of lead," said Dame Peterson. "She can't see a hem without stepping on it. Still, the hungry rarely get a holiday, so I will come."
"You're a good woman to venture out in this cursed cold. On Christmas Eve, I'd rather be home with my wife or my grog."
But Dame Peterson turned to Frederick.
"Dear boy, I've never left you at night before. Will you be safe?"
Frederick nodded. So Dame Peterson left, muttering to the coachman,
"One of God's simples, that boy. Can't find his way from soap to water. I hate to leave him alone on Christmas Eve."
Frederick waited until the sound of hooves had faded, and then he wrapped himself in a scarf. His townspeople needed to sail to lonely souls and invite them to live on their island. So Frederick would locate a boat. In a lane off the main square, a small girl shivered in her threadbare shawl. All day, she had been hoping to sell the matches in her apron pocket. All day long, she had sung,
"Light your tapers on Christmas Eve with a new match."
But she hadn't sold a single match, and by nighttime, her voice had shriveled.
"Matches? I have matches for sale."
She didn't dare go home without a single coin, and home held no warmth anyway, not since the death of her mother. She wandered this way and that. How crowded the streets were this late on Christmas Eve. As she was crossing the boulevard, a pair of horses dragging a coach raced by. The girl dashed out of their way. The slippers that had belonged to her mother. They were too loose, but all the girl had left of her. They fell off. A carter's donkey claimed one slipper for its supper. "Oh!" cried the match girl. "Oh!" The other slipper might keep one foot warm, she thought, but as she went to retrieve it, a boy about her age was picking it up. "This will make a fine cradle for my babies," and ran off into the darkness so quickly that he never heard her voice calling after him. The crowds thinned and disappeared. Alone, the match girl tucked herself into an alley, out of the wind, but not the cold. She couldn't go home, and she couldn't sell any matches. So what was there left to do but strike one to relish the light? She lit it. Warmth for the tip of her nose, at least, and the tiny blaze confused her eyes. She thought she saw an iron stove with brass trimmings. The coal door opened so the heat could escape. She reached for it, and the match went out. She crouched, half asleep, till a church bell rang. It was a quarter to midnight, so she lit another match. And in the flare she saw a roast goose on a platter, amid silverware and crystal and creamy napery. "Oh, goose," she called, and it rose on its roasted legs and walked across the table toward her, the knife and fork in its back waggling in a comical way. She laughed and put her hand to her mouth, but the match burned out, and the goose disappeared, and the pretty table with it. "Come back!" She struck a third match. This time, a Christmas tree rose high above her. She craned her head to see the pine boughs laden with glass ornaments and with candles shining bright as stars. The highest candle served as the beacon, but then it streaked earthward. "Mother said when a star falls, it means a soul is going up to God, so someone is dying," she remembered. Then midnight chimed, and the thought of her mother cheered her so that the little girl struck another match. In the flinty light, she saw her mother, who lived in heaven, but who now leaned forward with her smile, her bright and matchless eyes. As the vision faded, the match girl despaired, and she lit match after match to hold the vision. Mother looked so inviting, and then her warm arms were around her daughter, and the mother took her home to the sky, where the stars shine like matches that can never be extinguished.
This is music composed by David Lang. His Little Match Girl Passion won this year's Pulitzer Prize for Music. It'll be released next year. We've been listening to Gregory Maguire reading his original story, Matchless, on All Things Considered. Stay with us now for the second part of his new take on the Hans Christian Andersen story, The Little Match Girl.
Frederick got home in time to stir the fire before the coals went out, which was lucky, for he had no way to start a new fire. When his mother returned, she said,
"I'd have stopped to buy matches with the Queen's bonus, but I saw no vendors at work this late on Christmas Eve. Now, off to your attic. I'll stay by the stove and keep the fire alive till Christmas morn."
But sitting to take off her shoes, she leaned against a pillow and immediately fell asleep. All night, Frederick sat nodding by the stove. Sometimes he imagined climbing into a comfortable shoe and sailing off to find a more hospitable place to live, a place where the poor did not shiver so, and the hungry could find enough to eat, and the children had all the parents they needed. Whenever a coal tumbled, startling him, he tended the fire with a poker, managing to keep the room tolerably warm until dawn.
"Christmas Day, my dimpled dumpling! Oh, la! Precious oranges and anise cookies and fragrant dust of nutmeg to stir in their morning milk." While Dame Peterson dawdled over her tea, Frederick hurried upstairs to arrange his little folk in their new boat and help them set sail to find their necessary neighbors and kin. Setting the slipper down, however, he shook something in it loose, an iron key with a paper tag attached. Now Frederick guessed that the shoe had been lost by accident. Since he couldn't understand his letters, he plunged downstairs to ask his mother to read the tag. It was an address. "An invitation?" wondered Frederick.
"A nuisance," said his mother. But he pestered her until she was overcome. She knew he couldn't find an address on his own, So they made their way, hand in hand, across the causeway and through quiet streets to locate the address attached to the key. When you've never heard its like before, it is hard to recognize the sound of human grief. At first, Frederick thought it was seagulls, but his mother insisted, "We have come at an unfortunate moment." Frederick darted ahead anyway. He pressed through a crowd of neighbors, and he climbed a steep staircase to a room over a warehouse. There he found a frozen girl lying on a table, and her father fitfully rocking nearby, his eyes shut.
"Who are you?" asked a busybody neighbor. "And what business have you come in here in this time of sorrow?"
"Last night I found this in a lost slipper." Frederick held up the key. The gossipy neighbor wondered aloud.
"Was this why the girl had not returned? Had she lost her key? And her father, living so high above the warehouse, would never have heard her knocking. He had been out of his mind with work and worry, tending his two babies who squalled with a consumption that had already claimed his wife. And now, it seemed, had stolen his daughter, too."
When Dame Peterson arrived, puffing from the effort, she covered Frederick's face with her apron, while grim-eyed men carried the girl's body away for a pauper's burial. Frederick's mother motioned that it was time to leave. But then she caught sight of one of the sick babies, gray as bad bacon in the morning light. She had the poor thing to her bosom before she knew what she was doing, so Frederick cradled the other one as best he could. As they held the children, their own family began to change, though they didn't see it at the moment. When the new year was scarcely a week old, Dame Peterson helped the match girl's father to secure a position as the new coachman to the Queen. And before the year was halfway old, Dame Peterson had married the man and invited him and his two frail daughters to share the rooms behind the smokehouse. The family was still hard-pressed for money and dreamed of savory treats to eat, but they had the warmth of each other and enough on which to live. And in most parts of the world, that is called plenty. As the year surged on, the Queen continued stamping on her hems. There were gowns to be mended every night. The following Christmas Eve, Frederick's mother decided to spend the night at the palace, leaving her new husband to keep the stove fire burning. She brought her needles and threads, but, distracted by kissing her three children, she forgot to take her supper. Frederick offered to carry the meal to his mother. "I can find my way," he promised his stepfather. His delighted mother applauded his success at finding the palace, and in holiday spirits, the Queen lunged to hand three pieces of marzipan to Frederick, ripping a royal seam as she did. Hurrying home that Christmas Eve, however, Frederick grew uncertain. An unseasonal thaw was wreathing the city in a clammy mist, disguising the landmarks on which Frederick relied. Tonight it seemed as if all the ghosts of all who had died since last year had risen one last time to see in the holy day. Frederick wasn't frightened of ghosts, and though the world was masked with vapor, eventually he found the causeway. Starting across, he heard a belligerent sound. He recognized it as plates of ice jamming in the mouth of the harbor channel, grinding their cold edges against one another. With the outlet plugged and the snow melting, the harbor water was rising. Inches of seawater flooded the causeway. He stood still, He couldn't see his way forward along the causeway, nor could he retrace his steps. A false step would drown him, and no boat in the shape of a mother's slipper would come sidling up to rescue him. "Oh," he prayed aloud, "let me get home to my sisters. I have marzipan fruits for them." The water lapped higher as bells began to ring in the muffling fog. He blinked, and then he saw a little light, a momentary flare held out by an invisible hand. He reached toward it, and the light went out. But, look, another, several feet beyond. So he took a step forward. A third flame winked beyond that, and then a fourth. Small, brief lights, but as helpful as matches, struck just in time. And Frederick followed the chain of evanescent stars across the dark water to safety. Some people know better than to announce if a little light has appeared to them. Frederick didn't confide in his mother when she returned the next morning with pastries and lingonberry jam. He wanted to tell his stepfather. There were reasons not to be sad on this Christmas anniversary, but he didn't know how. Instead, he said to his sisters, "Eat up your marzipan. I have a surprise upstairs to show you." Then he carried both girls up the ladder to share with them his secret town, whose population had enjoyed a marked increase over the past year. His sisters clapped their hands, unaware that high above them, even in the daylight, exists a population of stars.
We've been listening to Gregory Maguire reading his original story, Matchless. It's based on Hans Christian Andersen's classic fairy tale, The Little Match Girl. Maguire's story was commissioned by All Things Considered. It was edited by Ellen Silva and produced by Melissa Gray. Matchless will be published in 2009. I'm Robert Siegel. Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah from all of us here at All Things Considered at NPR News.